Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Hackers were working to infiltrate the 23rd Winter Olympics in South Korea long before they launched the games last week. More than 300 Olympics-related computer systems already have been hit. Even as local and international law enforcement agencies work to stem the breaches, fear of more serious cyber attacks remains. New York Times cybersecurity reporter Nicole Perlroth recently wrote about the threats of hacking and the Olympics. Check out the link to her story at WOSU.org/allsides. Nicole Perlroth joins us now by phone. Welcome back.
Hi, Ann. Thanks for having me.
This isn't the first time cybersecurity has been a concern at an international sporting event, right?
That's right. There's been a couple of attacks that we've highlighted some of our recent reporting, but one of the ones that's probably most applicable to the Olympics was a threat to the 2012 London Games, actually, in the 24 hours before those games were set to begin, a group of investigators uncovered attack plans on a hacker's computer in England that showed that they had access to the blueprints to the stadium, the software blueprints, and were intending on shutting the lights down in the stadium. That attack was mitigated. There was another attack on the World Track and Field Championships last summer. That looked initially to be like it was a Russian group that was attacking, but later when they dug in, they found out that actually the attack was written in Chinese code.
What is the sense that they're trying to achieve with these attacks? When we talk about attacks, what do we mean by that? What are their goals? Do we know?
We don't really know yet, although we had some hint over the weekend. So starting back in late fall of last year, there was a lot of activity that security researchers were picking up. There were a lot of these so-called spear phishing emails directed at sports officials and Olympic officials, at the International Hockey Organization, the Luge Federation, the IOC. But it wasn't clear really what they were after, although in some cases they were just stealing their usernames and passwords to various systems. And really, the gist, at least until a couple of weeks ago, was we know that they've been compromising some of these Olympic-related organizations, but we don't know who they are, and we don't know what their eventual attack plan is. Then on Friday, just as the opening ceremonies were set to begin in Pyeongchang, you saw this sudden shutdown of internet access, which ended up doing quite a bit of damage. You saw some of the drones that broadcasters were using to film the opening ceremonies couldn't deploy. People couldn't get to the Pyeongchang2018.com website, so they couldn't print out their reservations. So even though this was pretty much a sold-out event, you saw a lot of empty seats in the crowd. It disrupted broadcasting plans and telecasts. And when over the weekend, as people were sort of parsing out, well, was this just a random internet outage or was this a cyber attack? They found out it actually, yes, this was a cyber attack. It was an intended to sow disruption at the opening ceremonies. And they had used some of the credentials that they've been stealing over the past few months. So we don't know if this is the end game, just to disrupt the opening ceremony, but we know that this is just potentially stage one in a series of attacks we might see at the Olympics.
The security company McAfee said that the attack had the hallmarks of a nation state. How does that? What's the distinguishing evidence in that score?
So usually when people say this has the hallmarks of a nation state, they're referring to a couple things. One is, when they're attacking a system, does the attack have any kind of profit motivation? And in this case, it didn't. They were really attacking these sports organizations that there was no financial incentive whatsoever. So they could kind of rule out your money-seeking cyber criminals. The other elements of the attack that suggested this was a nation state more than some kind of cyber criminal group was that it was really well organized. It looked like it was heavily resourced. There was, it looked like it was, there was a lot of coordination going on, which always tells you that this is something that could only be pulled off by a nation state. And there were several phases to the attack. So But what's really troubling about this is that really when I've been talking to these security researchers, all of them say the same thing, which is, we think this is a nation state, but we don't know which one. And we know they're tracking a lot of these names that have now become familiar to all of us since the 2016 election. We know that they're tracking one Russian group named Fancy Bear, which has ties to Russian intelligence services, that group's been pretty active in targeting some Olympic-related organizations. But they haven't been able to tie the specific attack at the opening ceremonies or some of the escalating activities in recent weeks back to that group. Some others have suggested that there might be a Chinese element here. Security people at the Security Command Center in Pyeongchang, working with Olympic coordinators, have found that they're all just monitoring for a potential threat from North Korea. So at this point, it's just anyone's guess.
The International Olympic Committee could penalize countries if they're found to be hacking, right? Or what are the rules on that score?
That's right. And I don't know if they've actually formalized rules for this yet. You know, we're all operating in this brave new world these days. But ostensibly, you think that some of the consequences could include a ban on a country's athletes or, you know, full ban from the games. But really, in this case, what the challenge they're up against is, you know, first of all, mitigating this, and nothing bad comes of this. There's a lot of attack scenarios people have thrown out there. The only one we've seen so far is the big internet outage at the opening ceremonies. But people have talked about, you know, the risk to some of the digital systems that are used for scoring, or, you know, now digital systems are responsible for something called Snowgate, which tells skiers when they can leave the gate and starts timing them. And all these things could be potentially vulnerable. But in this case, you know, they have to mitigate those threats. And then second of all, they have to come up with the evidence to find out who's behind this to actually implement some kind of consequence.
How connected are the games now? How much is left that isn't connected digitally there?
So the games are definitely more digitized than ever before, and it runs the gamut. But, you know, starting at the top, we have a stadium where the lights and power are now remotely accessible through software. We have electronic scoring results, I mentioned. We also use digital systems to do things like I mentioned before, but, you know, trigger when people are leaving the gates for their downhill race. The scores from judges are sent in electronically and then often averaged out. So if someone was to tweak one judge's score, it might be difficult to ascertain right away that score had been manipulated. Someone could turn the lights off in the stadium mid-skating event. I mean, these are all scenarios that cybersecurity experts have posited. And of course, these are worst-case scenarios, but, you know, in talking to the people on the ground, it sounds like they try to mitigate what they can, although most of their resources in terms of security are still directed towards sort of physical threats, like bombs and that kind of thing. And then they look at cyber threats. And even then, you know, there's so much luck involved in the security of the game.
Yeah, I'd ask you, you know, I talk all the time about how sophisticated the hackers are getting, you know, particularly if they're controlled or resourced by a nation state out there. But what about the security companies? What about the security people? Are they keeping up with this?
You know, I've gotten some mixed answers on this. So security firms are definitely monitoring these threats. And they've been picking up some digital exhaust over the last couple of months that suggests, yes, there's multiple groups that are interested in probing Olympic networks and Olympic-related organizations, networks, and sports networks. Problem is, in the past, you know, banks, technology companies with highly valuable intellectual property, they were the ones that were really active, proactive about monitoring for cyber threats. Then you had maybe retail organizations. They were sort of waking up to this cyber threat with Target and Home Depot and Neiman Marcus and all the hacks we saw a couple of years ago. Sports is a new one. You know, sports is something that traditionally has not been seen as a potentially vulnerable sector. But over the last few years, what we've seen is that nation states and activists see these as serious foreign policy realms, where if they have a political axe to grind, this is a great way to grind it, is by potentially targeting some of these big sporting events. Like I mentioned, the World Track and Field Championships last summer, the 2012 Olympic Games, and now the Pyeongchang Games. The problem is information sharing. So security firms, yes, they are monitoring this. Yes, there are people now at the embassy, from the Department of Homeland Security, from some of the intel agencies, who are monitoring for threats to American athletes and American venues. And then there's this sort of smorgasbord of security experts at the IOC themselves, who are monitoring for threats from an unmarked security command center. But overall, what I've been getting is sort of mixed report cards on how this is all playing out. And really what we've been hearing is that the information sharing, in terms of sharing cyber threat intelligence, is still not where it needs to be, and certainly not where it would be if this was Davos or some huge delegation of diplomats and government officials from around the world, or in the banking sector or tech sector. Things are just not where they are supposed to be in the sports realm just yet.
Is there a sense that there are some places that are better prepared than others, South Korea versus another country, or what? I mean, I'm wondering in the future if it'll affect where games are located.
I think it will. What we've heard is that among the group of people at the Security Command Center, there's a heavy South Korean presence, obviously. And the South Koreans are not strangers to these cyber threats. You know, they're constantly on the lookout for cyber attacks from North Korea. So they're sort of veterans at this thing. And then, even though there's only, a few Israeli athletes compared to some of the other countries represented at the games, Israel is heavily represented among those who are monitoring for security threats. Also, for obvious reasons, they're veterans at this stuff. And then there's the U.S., the U.K., other countries in Europe. But I think you're right. I think at this point, Olympic officials have to ask themselves, can they host the games somewhere where the local law enforcement and intelligence agencies on the ground are not prepared to handle some of these cyber threats? As the Olympics gets more digitized, as hackers get more sophisticated, it seems that they really need to start considering this as one of the things that they're talking about when they're considering where to host the games. Now, the 2020 Olympics are going to be in Tokyo. And when I talked to some of the security folks, they said, at the 2012 games, cybersecurity wasn't even brought up as a factor in those games, the consideration of putting those games in London. But now it was the top factor in hosting the games in Tokyo.
Nicole Perlroth, thanks so much for joining us. I appreciate your time as usual.
Thanks, Anne. There's a lot to discuss here. Sorry if I was talking very loud.
Not at all. Nicole Perlroth is a cybersecurity reporter for the New York Times. She recently wrote about the threats of hacking and cyber attacks and what could be done to prevent further damage. You can check out her article on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Moving on with Tech Tuesday, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. In the age of the internet search engine, if you ask a question, a list of results is at your fingertips before you know it. But the list is not without bias, and that includes racism. Sophia Noble teaches information studies at the University of Southern California. She's written a new book titled Algorithms of Oppression, How Search Engines Reinforce Racism. She joins us by phone. Welcome, Sophia Noble.
Thank you. Good morning.
Just to start off, talk about the difference in the search results when you Google the term white girls versus the term black girls. Give us a thumbnail on what's the difference.
Well, one of the things that you see when you Google the word black girls, and this was the case for many years, we started looking at this around 2009, is that you would be met with a first page that was almost exclusively pornography or hypersexualized content. And conversely, interestingly, when you'd look up a term like white girls, you know, you might find the film White Girls by the Wayans brothers. You might find things like white girls' dresses or clothing, kind of really referring to white as a color. Because, of course, we know that many girls who are white in our society, kind of white American, don't refer to themselves as white. So the concept is actually represented quite differently.
And you've coined the term technological redlining to describe some of what's going on here. Tell us what you mean. Well, we know redlining had to do with real estate, but tell us how you use a parallel for that with this issue.
Yes. So, you know, in the old days, not so old days, mm-hmm. redlining was a process of discriminating against primarily communities of color. We would see this in terms of higher interest rates, for example, in banking and finance or insurance, premiums being higher. We see a similar phenomenon happening now on the internet where groups are who are already marginalized in our society come to be highly misrepresented, also start to lose control over the ways in which their communities and their identities are represented. And we see these systems, these technical systems that we're increasingly reliant upon, sorting us and creating profiles for us that we can't entirely access, that we can't, in fact, intervene upon. And these are some of the things that I think we need to be incredibly mindful of. I coined this as kind of a technological redlining that I also think is profoundly connected to various forms of data discrimination.
Is anybody doing this on purpose?
It's a good question. I mean, I don't think that Silicon Valley software engineers sit down and say, let's create the most nefarious kinds of technologies we can. Certainly not. What I think happens is that over time, systems start to become more intelligent. They're designed to reinforce the data sets that they're using to kind of create their algorithms. And what often is happening is the data sets that they're using are already biased, and this reinforces the bias. But then when we start to extend this into new projects like machine learning and artificial intelligence, it becomes quite difficult to see where those biases exist. They just become totally normalized.
What are some other search results that you've focused on in your research that have illustrated this concept?
Well, you know, the book kind of takes us into a gradual look at some of the problems. Of course, I start with looking at girls and women of color and how we're terribly misrepresented and have been over time. Latina girls and Asian girls are still highly connected to pornographic information. But then when you start to look at other things like concepts, for example, for many years, if you did a search on the keyword beautiful in Google's image search, you would get back almost exclusively sexualized or pictures or sexually objectifying pictures of white women. And I thought this was quite interesting because, for me, the concept beautiful might be represented by nature or something more universally thought of as beautiful. Mm-hmm. Finally, Google image search did change the algorithm, and now nature is, in fact, what you get. But the book actually starts to look at some of the darker consequences, I think, of some of the search results. And I write a whole chapter about Dylann Roof and the way in which he reported out in his kind of own manifesto that he was trying to make sense of the news story.
This is, of course, the guy who shot and killed all those people in that church in
South Carolina.
Right. Okay.
Yes. The one roof. Yes. Yep. White nationalists killed the 9 African Americans in the Emmanuel AME Church in Charleston, South Carolina, a couple of summers ago. Mm-hmm. You know, when you looked at Dylann Roof's manifesto, one of the things he said was that he was trying to make sense of the news reporting that was going on around the death of Trayvon Martin and the trial of George Zimmerman. And what he did was he entered queries that led him immediately to white supremacist websites that confirmed patently false notions about race in contemporary American society. And then I think we could easily argue kind of radicalized him around white nationalism. And this, of course, we know ended in a terrible, terrible tragedy. So that this kinds of queries people present to search engines, you know, if you're looking for where the closest Starbucks is, they might be perfectly fine. But when you start asking more complex questions about the meaning of things, this is where we get into a lot of trouble. And I think there's dire consequences over time for this.
Google search is ultimately an advertising vehicle. How do commercial interests come into play in racist or sexist results?
It's a great question. Most people think of Google as kind of a public information portal. They think of it as a place that provides credible, vetted information back to them, websites and otherwise. What in fact it is an advertising platform. People pay Google, whether it's high-priced advertising clients, large corporations, to small, you know, projects that everyday people have around their blogs where they're willing to pay money to optimize certain keywords in order to have their content be found. So what we see in the case of racist and sexist information that comes back around particular concepts is that some companies, industries, or individuals, movements and organizations are willing to pay to optimize their content around those keywords. This means that people who have the least amount of resources, the least amount of money, quite frankly, and the least technical skill are the most likely to have concepts that are associated with them marginalized or misrepresented.
How does the role of net neutrality or the absence of it, given the new administration and its abolishment of those net neutrality rules at the FCC level, come into play here?
Well, it's interesting. I think that the net neutrality issue will be slightly different in that we will have kind of a potentially more premium internet that people will pay for with even more kind of commercially optimized content with, you know, content that needs faster bandwidth, especially around kind of video and news and that kind of thing. And we'll have people who will be in a second tier internet for which they don't pay a premium, and they may not be able to access this. Now, one of the ways that we could think of this is that the premium internet that might emerge with the abolition of net neutrality might mean that people are more aware that that's content that's kind of sponsored or paid for. So that's one way we could also interpret what will happen, and that the rest of us who don't have millions of dollars to spend on our content might be in the kind of the public version of the internet,
which might kind of become is popular, couldn't it?
It could, but it could also become just total trash. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think what we see now is a real devolving of the kinds of content available. Of course, we see, you know, I've been talking about this for many, many years about mm-hmm. what's happened with women and girls, and particularly kind of their identities being marginalized. And nobody was particularly interested until the same phenomena of gaming the system resulted in kind of a huge effect on the U.S. presidential election. So now we're talking about these platforms in different ways, and I think that's really important. And of course, we need to keep an eye on things like net neutrality, but we also need to think about what does it mean for a handful of companies to really control the information landscape. And these are companies that are ultimately about making money. They're not the public libraries mm-hmm. of the internet. their advertising platforms to make money.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest is Sophia Noble. She's an assistant professor of information studies at the University of Southern California and author of the new book titled Algorithms of Oppression, How Search Engines Reinforce Racism. Questions or comments, 614-292-8513. Why can't these search algorithms simply be fixed or re-engineered to remove some of this bias?
You know, Anna, I think part of the problem is that these algorithms have become so complex, it's not even easy for the technical systems, for the engineering teams to intervene upon that. One of the things we see is that when there's bad publicity, Google in particular will go in and it will just quietly tweak its mm-hmm. algorithm and make some changes. But, you know, ultimately, I think that these platforms are not particularly interested in broadcasting widely that they are manipulating the kinds of results that we see. They actually derive a huge benefit from the public thinking that what they bring back is the best quality information you can get. So I think this is one of the reasons why we don't have more of these conversations about the bias kind of happening in the wider public.
And by the way, Google it's the dominant search engine, but it isn't the only one out there. Are these problems the same throughout, just at different degrees?
They really are. I mean, the idea of search is really about kind of paid advertising or optimizing paid content. And most of the other players are really trying to model from Google because it is kind of the monopoly leader. I do think that there are some platforms. I mean, certainly we see a small engine like DuckDuckGo that is at least doing things like not collecting all of the places that we travel around on the internet, and it's more privacy oriented. But to some degree, that helps in at least having the things you've looked for in the past not have as much impact on the kinds of things that you might find today.
Hmm. And some search engines have become so dominant in how we get information. You argue that more public oversight and accountability are called for. What are you thinking about there? What would that look like?
Well, one of the things that I think could serve, two main things that I argue. We certainly need regulation in our information environment. In the media industries, for example, media companies have certain kinds of regulatory frameworks that they have to work within around they have a responsibility for the kinds of potential harms that can come through their media channels.
Like the seven and dirty words, that kind of a thing?
Exactly, okay. Exactly. There's at least kind of an ethical standard or framework that media companies work within. One of the problems has been that tech companies like Google and Facebook in particular have done is they've really always argued that they are tech companies and not media companies, that they're platforms that are not responsible for the content that moves through their platforms. But of course, we know this is not true. They are, in fact, also media companies. And so I think that if we think about regulation of tech companies as media companies, that's certainly a first step in the right direction. But I think we also need public interest alternatives. And one of the things I really argue for in the book is what would it look like if we had a public interest search portal that was created and curated and managed by, say, librarians and other teachers, faculty, researchers, people who were other kinds of information experts who might have a deep training and an eye for what we're now calling, you know, fake news or bad information or things that aren't really vetted or kind of based in evidence. And I think that imagining an alternative is something that is quite exciting to do.
I'm just trying to think about the resources that could ever be brought to bear on such a thing, because you're even talking about it's a hassle even for the engineers to go in and disrupt the algorithms once they get started and start building on so much data over the course of years. I'm just wondering how the mere humans could go up against that?
Well, listen, we have amazing information institutions already in this country. We have academic libraries. We have public libraries. We have people who have, you know, invested their careers and their expertise in curating knowledge, quite frankly. Mm-hmm. So one of the things that I do is I talk to a lot of the large library and kind of information organizations about turning some of their attention toward the open web, not just curating scholarly information, academic knowledge, but also what would it mean for them to use that expertise on the open web. That would, in fact, you know, I see that kind of aligned with something like the Library of Congress. What would it mean? We have institutions that are, in fact, national treasures, and we have people who have the expertise, but we haven't really deployed those resources, and certainly the resources of taxpayers, in that direction. And I think that bolstering taxpayer investment in those directions might be an interesting new frontier to think about.
What is your sense? What do you hear from librarians and such about the prospects of that?
Well, I think for many of them, it's daunting, but I think it's also exciting. I've talked to many of the university, kind of head university librarians at large research and private institutions, and, you know, from MIT, you know, to other places, and they're quite excited at the thought of doing something like that. But of course, librarians, as you know, don't have nearly the capital and resources that a company like Google has. So this would take a priority, a national prioritization in terms of our own public policy, our congressional spending toward the Library of Congress, the Digital Public Library of America, and other kinds of information organizations. And you know, it would require, I think, Congress to think about what resources we already have, what resources we need, and how that factors into their very real concerns about the flow of mis and disinformation in our society.
You wrote that artificial intelligence is going to become a major human rights issue in the 21st century. What are you getting at there, and what does that have to do with this?
Well, it's interesting because artificial intelligence, and I put that a little bit in quotey fingers, but or maybe kind of the way that machines are being taught to learn is happening based on the kinds of information that already exists on the internet. So think back to a few minutes ago in our conversation where I talk about, you know, this kinds of pervasive racist and sexist misinformation that circulates all through the internet. Disinformation in all kinds of ways. Well, the machines are learning from that content to become the new artificial intelligence. And I think that what's quite concerning is that artificial intelligence is not something we can take to court when it discriminates against us, right? We don't have a legal framework for thinking about what happens when decisions are made about us automatically that we can't intervene upon. We're not even sure how those decisions were derived, and they just become flat and normalized, just how it is. And those things, I think, are something we should pay deep attention to. I think we'll see an exacerbation of social inequality that will come from automated decision-making systems that human beings have a hard time intervening upon.
Sophia Noble, thanks for joining us today. I really appreciate your time.
Thanks so much, Anne. It was a pleasure.
Sophia Noble is an assistant professor of information studies at the University of Southern California, author of the new book titled Algorithms of Oppression: How Search Engines Reinforce Racism. More Tech Tuesdays coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The 23rd Winter Olympics in South Korea may feel a world away for most of us. Some news organizations are working on augmented reality apps to bring the games closer to home. Joining us now to talk about that and other tech news is contributing editor at Android Central, Russell Holley. Welcome back, Russell.
Thank you.
So last week, the New York Times published a story featuring augmented reality. How did it work?
It worked in two different ways. If you were looking at just your web browser, then it was, 360-degree images of four different athletes, all in different poses for their respective sports. But if you were looking at it on an iPhone, then you actually had the opportunity to place those athletes in front of you in a way that you could actually walk around the athletes in the middle of any of the positions that they were in and see the kind of, physical exertion that went into doing the things that got them to the Olympics.
Like what?
The most, impressive from my perspective was the hockey stance. When you go to present this this kind of image in your living room and suddenly there's a, a life-sized human being, in full hockey gear standing in front of a goal. And as you walk around, the app itself is walking you through how much energy went into, keeping the glove open at a maximum rate or the stance that needed to be taken in order to, protect as much space as possible. And it did this for figure skating and for snowboarding and for speed skating as well. And each one of them, just incredibly impressive to really lean in, and look at things like, the kind of protective gear that speed skaters wear on their hands so that they can, take, turns even sharper than you would think, possible. It was really cool to see.
I'm trying to figure out, is this a projection of something? Is this on my phone? When you say life size, how does this manifest?
Well, so it takes your camera and it places an object in the room as though it were really there. And as you move around looking through your the camera on your phone, so the closer you get to where this thing is positioned, then the closer that image appears to you. So it's not a projection, but it can feel like it, when you're kind of, leaned in to see how some of this works.
What is the process of getting that three-dimensional image of an athlete into an augmented reality app? How do they do that?
In this case, it's capturing hundreds of images and stitching them all together so that you have this kind of 360-degree rotation of what's going on. And 360-degree images of individual things is not a new concept, but being able to capture it in motion is complicated, to have that much detail to be able to kind of lean, zoom in or lean in and see things is really complicated to manage, which is why it's not something that's done in real time. Like, we're not seeing things that are actually happening at the Olympics right now. These are images that were taken well before and then assembled and put into the app.
And the resolution, is it different when you do a close-up versus a far away?
The resolution's about the same, but it's certainly, because you're getting closer to it, it's a larger image. So, the thing appears to be physically bigger the closer you get to it.
What about the Washington Post? They have an augmented reality feature for the Olympics too, right?
Yes, this was really different. This was, instead of looking at individual athletes, it was looking at the sports themselves, and it kind of surprised me. There was a lot of information in it I didn't know. It's presented almost like a game, where you choose, two different sports, be it distance skiing and speed skating or the luge or snowboarding, and it shows you which of those two events are faster. The average speed of someone performing that sport, which was faster in this kind of augmented reality racetrack. So you've got this, you instead of projecting a single person, you've got this kind of downward snow slope that is now in front of you, and you can see, visually which one is faster. And then when one wins, it shows you, the average speed of some of these Olympic athletes. And it was incredible to see just that much information, how fast some of these people are going.
Are these apps easy to use? Can anyone do them?
Yeah, the whole point is that these are built into the normal apps on your phone for the New York Times and the Washington Post. That was what, you know, they're designed so that if you have the classic Washington Post app or just the normal New York Times app, when you open the app and you go to this article, it'll ask you for permission to use your camera. And then once you grant that permission, then it gives you very simple instructions for doing this.
Does it use a lot of energy, a lot of data?
Anything that uses your camera kind of actively is going to use a little bit more power than normal, but it's not going to use a whole lot of data. It's you know, basically the same amount of information as a video article that you would get from either of these apps.
So what do you think is interesting about combining journalism and augmented reality? Are you thumbs up?
I'm definitely thumbs up. This is a hands-on way to kind of observe a story, and this is something that we've seen a lot of different publications do for not just virtual reality but augmented reality as well, where it gives someone the ability to feel more like a part of the story. You know, when you can place an object in front of you and walk around it and do everything but touch it. You know, it gives you a greater sense of impact.
There has been a shakeup at Google smart home brand Nest. Let's talk about that. First of all, remind us about the different products in the Nest line of products.
Nest started out as a thermostat company. The creator of the original iPod designed a thermostat that looked almost like a piece of art that you would hang on your wall, and brought some intelligence to thermostats. And they have since expanded to smoke detectors and security cameras and soon doorbells, just kind of smarter home appliances is essentially the thing that you don't think about using, but then actually end up using all the time is the goal of this company.
And Google bought Nest when?
Google bought Nest 2 years ago.
Okay.
And was originally going to just be its own standalone company that worked with Google. You know, it was a Google company, but it was not Google branded anything. It was still Nest branded things.
And now
and that has continued up until this point.
Yeah, now it's going to officially merge with Google's hardware division. The company's co-founders leaving the company. What does this all mean?
Well, there's been a lot of problems with some of the other Nest products over the last couple of years. You know, when the fire detectors first came out, they weren't quite as smart as sold. And there's actually some terrifying videos on YouTube of people who just kind of wake up at 2 o'clock in the morning because their fire alarm is going off for no reason. The fire alarm has been tripped by very sensitive things. And there have been problems with the hardware rollout for basically everything but the thermostat. And it had, it was kind of left a black mark that hasn't really recovered. The sales for everything other than the thermostat have not been particularly great. And with an increasing amount of people looking into things like smarter doorbells, because they act as, cameras that can record things, like FedEx people accidentally or on purpose hurling things onto your front porch, being able to have access to that information has value. And so Google wants to kind of absorb this company instead of let it exist as a standalone so that they can do a better job, promising a certain level of quality and delivering on it.
Has this been a bad deal for Google?
It hasn't been a bad deal from the perspective of the smart thermostat stuff and helping to understand what it is that Google needs to do in order to approach kind of the smart home tech, because a big concern 2 years ago when Google first purchased this company was personal data. There were a lot of people who weren't particularly comfortable with the idea of giving all of these people, giving all of this information about the stuff that you do in your home every day to Google. Mm-hmm. And so Google, has really taken that, over the last couple of years and worked on, how to explain what it is they do with people's personal data so that there's not a lot of concern there. And Nest was a big part of that to begin with.
And does this mean much for the average person out there who owns or plans to own a Nest product?
This isn't going to mean anything for the current services. If you have a Nest camera or a Nest thermostat, they're all going to remain the same. The Nest app is still going to be the default for everything for a long time. What this is going to mean is that future products might be released under the Google brand instead of the Nest brand. But They're still, especially when it comes to this thermostat, the Nest thermostat is still widely considered the best thermostat you can buy right now, as weird a concept as the best thermostat is. But
like, who cares?
Right. It's a thermostat, but you know, when you own one, it ends up making a lot of sense. But yeah, so there's a lot that goes into this particular brand right now. And so I think Google is going to keep it around for a while, but the inner workings are going to work much closer with Google's hardware team.
You also wanted to talk about a gripe you have with Nintendo and, you know, Hell Hath No Fury, like gamer scorned. What's going on?
This is the silliest thing that you're going to hear me complain about. And it's something that I complain about, and then my partner just kind of rolls eyes at me, and everyone just kind of mocks me for it. But I say it anyway. You know, I bought an iPad that had a cellular connection because I wanted to be able to use it, you know, kind of out. Our Apple Watches and tablets and other things like that have their own cellular connections. This Nintendo Switch is designed to be super portable. Its biggest feature is that you can pick it up and take it with you anywhere. But unless you have the ability to create a hotspot with your phone, you can't really connect to the internet anywhere other than Wi-Fi. And it would be fairly trivial for Nintendo to, you know, connect this to a cellular radio. They've worked with NVIDIA to create this hardware, and NVIDIA has several tablets and things that also have cellular radios in them. So this is it's a kind of trivial technical thing, but it is a complicated thing to talk about for Nintendo, because Nintendo sells these the Switch and the 3DS and the 2DS as things that are, you know, primarily for kids. But a lot of the purchasing data from this past year in particular has shown that adults have taken a real liking to the Nintendo Switch, even going so far in a lot of homes, not mine, I want to make that clear, in a lot of homes, is to buy multiple versions of these so that, like, mom and dad have their own version of the Switch and the kids have their own. And so in environments like that, where there's a lot of, you know, kind of when adults have taken over a platform that was originally designed for maybe teens, I'm wondering kind of out loud here what Nintendo is going to do next to you know, meet those adults and offer things that are just adult-like features, or if they're going to continue to just kind of stay the course and make things that are focused on kids.
All right, so let's first talk about the cellular connection or the mobile connection. Do you think Nintendo is going to make a Switch with a mobile connection?
It wouldn't surprise me, but I think that there are going to be some problems in doing so. It's gonna mean that the battery life on it is gonna drop a little bit, and that's on a console that already doesn't have spectacular battery life. And they're gonna have to find a way to make the monthly payment for a data connection something that's actually affordable, and that can be challenging when working with Verizon and AT&T. You know, right now, the data plan for the new Apple Watch is an extra $10 a month on what it is that you get out of it. And the Apple Watch uses very little data that doesn't come straight from your phone. You know, a lot of what the Apple Watch does is talk directly to your phone. Even when it's not connected to your phone, it doesn't use a whole lot of data for streaming music and things like that. So it would be, I'm fairly certain it would be a difficult sell for Nintendo to release something like this, and then have Verizon turn around and say, you have to pay the same amount for your video game console that you do for your phone. I think people are going to not buy that. But if it were something like $10 a month, I think that might actually work.
Because, again, the adult involvement in all of this, they can afford
right.
it. Yeah. Well, Russell Holly, I hope all your dreams come true.
Thank you.
I'm fingers crossed on the Nintendo Switch, and hopefully your partner won't be rolling her eyes as much if they do.
No. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Russell Holly, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate your time as usual.
Thank you for having me.
That's it for Tech Tuesday today. You've been listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Be sure to like All Sides on Facebook. Follow the show on Twitter at WOSU All Sides. And follow me on Twitter, too, at Ann Fisher WOSU. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.